So with the money left over, I went tearing back to Mojave, and we learned a lot. You learn more through failure than you do success. You learn more through a smoking hole in the ground than you do with a successful flight. So we went back and we rebuilt the capsule, and we had it just about all ready to go. And I developed a system that I didn't have to have this really frail envelope. In fact, I developed a system that I could stay in flight indefinitely at any altitude I wanted to. And I was really excited about doing that. And then one day there was a guy named, you've probably all seen him give a talk here. If I had to get beat by somebody, I needed to get beat by this guy. Anyway, in the thing called the Brightling Orbiter, their third attempt, they did an incredible flight, and they did fly around the world and landed in Egypt. And that morning, I went over there and looked on the TV or on the internet, and I said, as soon as the balloon crosses this line, they got the only plum on the tree, the first around the world in a balloon. And nobody cares anything about who did anything second. You know who broke the sound barrier second? Who's the second crew on the moon? Who's the second guy to fly New York to Paris? Anybody know? That's right. Chamberlain, that's very good. Who was, okay, here's, this is a great audience. Who was the second person to officially break the sound barrier after the General Chuck Yeager did? What? It was Hoover, but it wasn't Bob Hoover. It was a guy named Herbie Hoover. And there were two parallel programs, one that that NASA had and one that the Air Force had that Yeager was involved in. And they were a little bit more aggressive than the NASA guys. But anyway, a guy named Herbert Hoover was the second guy to officially break the sound barrier. And it was hard to find out who that was, but you may not know him because he got killed in a B-45 in a flight test program at Edwards just after that. But you get my point. So the capsule has been sitting in my hangar for over 10 years now. And we may do a high altitude, we're working on a high altitude parachute jump. Not me, I've already jumped enough. It's going to beat High Jump Joe's record. So anyway, that's the story of the Global Hilton. And it's failure, like I said, I look at it not as a failure, but as character development. And you learn a lot through failure than you do success. Now, here's the next one. Any questions about that I missed? Okay, here's the next one. It's called, how many of you have been to the North Pole? How many of you have stood on the ice at the North Pole? You have? And if there's anybody else out there, I can't see it. Most of you could have left and I'll never know. Oh yeah, there's people out there. But I've never done that. Okay, somebody calls me up one day and says, hey Dick, how would you like to fly an AN-2 Antonov Colt, you know, the big radial engine biplane to the North Pole? Now, remember when I started a program about freedom and flexibility? When I got out of the Air Force, I had to ask my boss or somebody to do something, get permission. And I worked for Burt for a handful of months, something like that, and I had to ask his permission. Well, that didn't last very long. But freedom and flexibility, when I finished that, I decided I was never going to work for anybody again, no matter how poor I was, because I value my freedom and my flexibility. And when somebody calls and says, hey, Dick, you want to go to the North Pole? I didn't have to ask anybody, even my wife. And when the tickets finally came to go to Anchorage, she went down and picked them up, and he says, you're really going to the North Pole? I says, yeah, I've been telling you that for a month. He says, well, I didn't believe you. Until she got a real strange phone call in her kindergarten class one day. And I'll get to that story. Okay, we got a crew. The guy has a brand new Antonov. It's the last one off the factory in Poland before it went bust. Very last Antonov ever built. And Ron was the owner of it, and he had it with some special fabric put on it and stuff. Really neat airplane. And he flew it from Russia back to Anchorage, Alaska, and he was going to outfit it for different expeditions and stuff. Neat guy. Guy's been flying long as I have. Ron. And he had this Antonov. Wow, we're going to the North Pole. I've never been to the North Pole before. This is really cool. So they put 350 gallons of fuel in the back seat in two big, huge tanks. We had an endurance of 24 hours. And we flew up to Barrow, Alaska, and filled everything up, and we took off from Barrow, heading for the North Pole. Now, it would take 12 hours to get to the North Pole from Barrow. And this Antonov, you know, it goes really slow, like 80 knots. And at first it was really cool, a couple hundred feet over the ice pack, and you could see the polar bears chasing seals and stuff. But a couple, 300 miles out, there wasn't any polar bears anymore. And then it was just the most incredible, magnificent desolation, I guess you'd call it. But hour after hour of this Arctic ice cap frozen, the leads would open up, and then they'd freeze over, and there's pressure ridges. And I try to imagine, who is it, Scott that went there supposedly first? Maybe I got my stories mixed up. But whoever was the first one that took a dog sled or hiked up there, I thought about, wow, it must have been really difficult. So anyway, we fly to the North Pole, and we find a place to land, and we land, and we have a Cessna with us, and you'll see that in the video, a Cessna 185, and he's got 320 gallons in the back seat, so we both have about 24 hours of endurance. And we landed at the pole, and before the engine would freeze, we only had about an hour, so we stand up and make the obligatory photograph, you know, with the tripod, and we land up there, hey, North Pole, cool, North Pole. And then we make some yellow snow and cross our fingers and push the start buttons. And if both of them start, cool, you're all happy, and then you take off. Now the heading we had from barrel to the pole, we just kept right on going with a 5-degree heading change. And the next set of islands we come to is called Spitsbergen. And there's a little town there called Longyearbyen. Really a neat place, isolated, no trees. Here again, magnificent, beautiful desolation of these archipelago of islands, gorgeous place. So we land there, spend 3 days, and then we get some old car gas, and like if you're bush pilots, you guys that fly up in the Arctic, what you do is you pump your own gas with a 55-gallon drum. So anyway, we fill up this Antonov with some unknown car gas, but the guy says it's a Russian airplane, it'll probably run on a rumor. And so, I'm in a co-pilot seat, and I have my little camera, and I'm filming things. And we take off, and now it's going to be 8 hours to the pole instead of 12, so we have a lot more fuel. But there was a protocol, and that was that the Cessna was going to land first because he had wheel skis, and he was going to drill a hole in the ice and find out how thick it was, and then he'd make a radio call and have the big Antonov come in. Now, I'm a good co-pilot, see, and I didn't say anything that we had violated that protocol twice, but I'm not going to say anything. These guys are bush pilots, and they would bug me. And I says, okay, I'm going to try to figure out our ground speed. And they'd say, ground speed? You damn desert rat? It's called ice speed up here. We're ice speed, not ground speed. Okay, sorry, I'll call it ice speed. That's cool. Now, the video I'm going to show you starts as we turn on final to the landing spot that they picked out to land at the North Pole again. Now, I've done all this before. I'm experienced. See, this is cool. Although I didn't really agree with where they were landing, but there's no way this desert rat's going to say anything about that. So sure enough, the Cessna comes in and he lands on his wheel skis, really cool. And we turn base and land right behind him and roll up side by side. And you'll see this in the video. We're sitting there side by side. And the pilot of the Cessna, Lee Heron, he's supposed to get a big ice auger and drill a hole in the ice to get the thickness, right? Okay, we're already there, so it's too late. His co-pilot is a lawyer, his name's John, and I'm filming him making a little yellow snow. And I accuse him, I says, hey, the Arctic ice cap got even with us for you doing that to it. But anyway, the guy gets out, drills a hole in the ice, and I'm kind of panning around looking at the different cockpit of the Antonov, and all of our GPSs to prove we were there. I zoom in on the GPS to show that it's 89.59.016. That's about as far as from here to the restaurant over there from the actual North Pole. So I can prove that we were actually there. Although it didn't look any different for the last 8 hours that we've been flying, but it's the North Pole. And then they wave us off, and that was a mistake too. We should have stayed right there, because we didn't know how much distance we had to take off straight ahead. So the only choice was to turn around or try to take off backwards the one we came in. And halfway around the turn, I don't blink, our North Pole trip comes to an abrupt end. Go ahead and run the video. Now, we're airborne now, and if you can look at the GPS. Now, there's a handful of minutes that I'm just panning around to give you some idea of what the Arctic ice cap looks like. Of course, according to Al Gore, it doesn't look like that anymore, but when we were there before Al Gore, then there was ice. But anyway, you can see the leads that open up. And in fact, the whole thing is so dynamic, it's going around clockwise, and it goes 4 to 12 miles a day. So if you're sitting there, you will drift that many miles away. So it's really active, and there's a lot of things going on. Okay, now we're on final approach, and you'll be able to pick up the Cessna here a little bit right ahead of us. But I want you to notice something, that the thickness of the ice is the color of the ice. The darker the color, the thinner it is, right? Now, if you look at the tracks that the Cessna makes, look real close at the tracks. When the snow is gone, they're dark purple. Right there is a clue that that darn ice is way too thin for us to land. So we touch down and we roll right up next to the Cessna. And come to a stop. Now, I've done this before. We let the engines cool down for a while, then we shut down. Get out and make yellow snow, take the photograph again. Really cool, I'm an old head at this. And there's Ron sitting at the controls. And you can pan around a little bit and you can see some of the Russian instruments. It looks like Kopech or something all the time. I don't know what they mean. Mixtures are hooked up backwards. You push it to turn it off, you gotta be careful of that one. Okay, we're sitting there, the engines are running. And I'm going to pan over here to prove that I was at the North Pole. Okay, there's the lawyer. He's taking a leak over there, making some yellow snow. Okay, John, let's go. Well, you would be too, I think, if you're crammed in a Cessna for 8 hours. Okay, he sounds like he's getting in pretty good shape there. Okay, here's Lee. See the ice auger he has? He put it together and he starts drilling a hole in the ice. Now, I'm going to zoom in on this thing. Now, if you look real close at the north latitude, see what it says? Yeah, 8959.016. Proof positive, right? Okay, now they drilled the hole and they found that it's too darn thin. They look over at our wheels and they're bent down in the ice. The ice is just bent underneath the big wheels. Now, look at them. They get really active. I'm sorry, but my monitor went dead. Do you see something there? Okay, it must still be working, but I can't see it. But anyway, they run around and they want us to get out of there. You know, go, 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 get out of there, get out of there. Okay, here it comes. So, no choice. He's going to turn around to take off the other way. He gets 90 degrees of turn and don't blink. The propeller's broken. The steam of the big radial as the Arctic water hits it. And now, get out, guys. Get out, get out. Now, I left the camera running, and you can see a rear end and a knee and all kinds of different things as these two guys are scampering out of that airplane before it actually goes under the water. Fortunately, it's a biplane and it has a low wing, right? So it kind of supports it. Now, okay, all you pilots and everybody know that what happens is if you have an emergency, you go and deal with it, see? And when it's all over, you stand back and you think, holy sugar, what happened to me? And then you get the shakes or go over the edge of the runway and throw up or something. But well, it's happening, you don't. So I'm walking around the airplane, filming it, as the nose is slowly going down through the Arctic Ocean. It finally dawns on me. I'm at the frappin' North Pole. The airplane is crap, and now I wonder what's going to happen now. But one thing I did know for sure, that it was going to be a much better chapter in my book. Okay, we can stop it. Guy's doing a great job. One more video clip. We got to stay at the North Pole, and neat thing, we're going to be rescued. See, the Cessna, he takes off, he puts out his HF radio, and he calls. And so right away, the rescue force, they get a C-130, and they're going to fly up there. And they're going to drop out two PJs. Now, the weather's fine, and nobody's hurt. And halfway up there, somebody says, wait a minute, there's five guys up there, the weather's okay, nobody's hurt. If we fly the C-130 all the way up there and these guys bail out, now we're gonna have seven guys up there to rescue instead of five. So anyway, they turned the C-130 around and went back, and they hired First Air, a Canadian place that does a Twin Otter, and they came up and got us after a while. Now, real quick thing. Now, we were just up there screwing off. It wasn't a scientific expedition or anything, or we weren't investigating the sex life of an ice worm or something significant that all the world needs. And we're trying to make up some story because this is gonna be a big rescue to get five guys from the North Pole. It's gonna be expensive. So we kicked it around a little bit about what we should tell them. And we allowed, it says, you know, there's nobody's gonna believe any of this. We're just guys screwing off, looking for adventure. But we had good, really good news because Ron was an Alaska survival or rescue hero, because there was a beaver that went out one day and he became missing up in Alaska, and they searched for 48 days and they couldn't find him. And Ron did not give up. He went and kept searching and searching for him, and within a handful of hours before the guy died, Ron found him and saved his life. Incredible story, and they made a big documentary out of it, and Ron was a big hero all over Alaska. And I thought, hey, you know, when Ron calls him up and say, you know, I'd really like for you guys to come and get us at the North Pole, I think everybody was more than happy to accomplish that.